Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes on the Zero Point Show through BBS Radio. It is Saturday, March 3rd, 2012. For those who have been following the show over the last weeks and months, you'll know that my co-host Jim has taken a sabbatical for a while from the show, and he's going to be coming back as an occasional book reviewer and commentator. And last week I announced that we had Dee Nicholson, who is going to be joining us as a regular co-host, and that Dee's specialty is in health freedoms and health legislation and such. But for today, I asked Dee to, we're going to begin Dee's regular stints next show, because today I have a special feature show which I've advertised up on my website for the last 2 weeks. And the today's show is going to focus on 9/11 investigations and the new conference coming up for 9/11 studies. And I have two major guests with me today. In the first hour, we have Jim Fetzer, and 9/11 truthers will certainly know Jim's work. He's been with the scholars for 9/11 Truth and has taken part in a number of conferences, has his own internet radio show, and has a remarkable series of interviews up on his website at The Real Deal. And we'll give the more specific information out later. Jim's the author of over 30 books and has been a professor in logic and has a wide area of expertise, and he has one of the greatest infectious laughs I know. So I'd like to bring on Jim Fetzer. How are you, Jim?
Oh, great, Christopher. I'm just delighted to be here. Yes, I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth in December of 2005. I organized the first conference from scholars in Madison to focus on issues related to the science and politics of 9/11. I edited its first book, The 9/11 Controversy, the 9/11 Conspiracy, which, by the way, fits on either the official account or alternative, since the official account includes 19 alleged Arab terrorists hijacking 4 aircraft. Since a conspiracy only requires 2 or more individuals collaborating together to bring about an illegal end, the official account is a conspiracy theory just as much as any alternative, where its major defect is that it is the theory that is most easily shown to be false. And now, as you implied, I have been organizing with Joshua Blakeney of Calgary, Canada, the Vancouver hearings, where anyone who would like to see what we're planning for 15 to 17 June this year can go to 911vancouverhearings.com and check us out.
And you have a very interesting letter up there. And perhaps, Jim, you might review some of the comments that have been made about the Toronto conference last year and what you felt its shortcomings were, and how, in a way, you're not attempting so much to critique that conference, but really to supplement it with new areas of investigation and go deeper into other issues. Maybe you could give some history in terms of the Toronto hearings.
Yes, well, the Toronto hearings, which were held in relation to the 10th observance of 9/11, were focused largely on the mode of destruction of the Twin Towers, where the principal participants and organizers included Kevin Ryan, formerly of Underwriters Laboratories Incorporated, and Niels Herrett, who is an associate professor of chemistry, who had been co-authors of an article about the discovery of nanothermite particles in the dust samples in New York, which has led them and Richard Gage, who is the founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, to promote the view that the nanothermite was the most probable explanation for the destruction of the Twin Towers. They presented views related to nanothermite that were not quite as clear-cut as what I have just described, no doubt because T. Mark Hightower, who's a chemical engineer, and I and others had been engaged in a small research group investigating the properties of nanothermite, where it turns out that nanothermite does not have the explosive potential to blow apart the towers as we observed. In fact, Christopher, the easiest refutation of the government's official account, which maintains that Twin Towers were both hit by aircraft, which incidentally entered all the way into the buildings before they exploded, that the fires that occurred weakened the steel and led to a progressive collapse from the top to the bottom, can be easily seen to be a false theory on the basis of the elementary consideration that a collapse is driven by gravity, which operates in one direction only, namely down, and that what we see in all the videos, which are, you know, indelibly imprinted on our memories, is those buildings blowing apart from the top down, where they're blowing apart in every direction. That's not a manifestation or effect of gravity, but is an expectable consequence of powerful explosives, which means when we understand that nanothermite does not have the explosive potential that has been attributed to it, it turns out to be a principle, a law of material science, that in order for an explosive to blow apart a material, it must have a detonation velocity equal to the speed of sound in that material, where it turns out that the speed of sound in concrete is 3,200 meters per second, in steel, 6,100 meters per second. But even nanothermite, this more refined version of thermite, only has an explosive velocity or a detonation velocity of 895 meters per second. Which means that nanothermite can't even pulverize the dust, much less shatter the steel in the Twin Towers. We had all hoped that during the Toronto hearings, Kevin Ryan, Neil Tarrant, and so forth would discuss Mark Hightower's results, which had been published in several articles prior to the meeting, including one early article entitled, "Has Nanothermite Been Oversold to the 9/11 Truth Community?" But also another, not long before, entitled, "Is 9/11 Truth Based Upon a False Theory?" where all of these considerations I've just outlined were presented in detail. And while some scientists have been very open-minded and receptive to Mark's discoveries, including Duane Dietz from 9/11 Truth San Diego, who's a very accomplished research scientist and who even contributed a diagram for the second of the articles I just mentioned, many others have been resistant. In fact, we were relatively astonished when the Hightower results were not discussed in Vancouver, where they needed to be addressed, and if they could be explained away, to be explained away, but otherwise taken into account. Because when you also consider the range of issues that were not addressed in Toronto, including minimal discussion about the Pentagon. It might have had a few sentences. In fact, Barry Zwicker actually organized a whole separate conference to complement the Toronto hearings elsewhere in the city, involving CIT and other groups to discuss the Pentagon. But it also didn't talk about, you know, the faking of all the plane crashes, which will be something we'll discuss in detail today, or the possible use of video fakery in New York, or what would have been involved in destroying the Twin Towers, where even if nanothermite had been involved, it's obviously not a sufficient explanation, and where a more recent article has now been published disputing whether the chips they found in the WTC dust were even nanothermite chips. But perhaps most importantly, it did not address who was responsible and why 9/11 occurred. So the point of the Vancouver hearings is going to be to complement, to make up for the shortcomings of the Toronto hearings by supplementing them with research, discussion, and debate on the issues which really were not adequately addressed during the Toronto hearings.
Yeah, with regards to the nanothermite, it seems when the Toronto Conference was coming up, Judy Wood had become quite prominent for her work, which raises all kinds of enigmas not explained by the nanothermite, especially what she calls the dustification process, which was what you were talking about, I think, when you're talking about the velocities approaching the speed of sound and such, and how nanothermite couldn't account for that. And I think people felt also, why were they excluding that as a critical piece of evidence, even pertaining to the collapse of the towers?
Well, you're absolutely right, Christopher. In fact, it's very surprising how exclusive have become certain factions within the broader 9/11 movement. Where the Steve Jones, Kevin Ryan, Niels Herit group has been very unsympathetic and not open-minded at all to work on the possible use of directed energy weapons. I have been a longtime supporter of research on the approach that Judy represents. In fact, in late 2006, Christopher, I began interviewing her on my then radio show and did so 15 times. Also, when I organized the Madison Conference, I featured her as the principal speaker and gave her an unprecedented 3 hours to speak. Wow. And when I published the 9/11 conspiracy, I included a chapter by Judy, which, based upon simple elements of Galileo's law of falling bodies, demonstrates that there cannot have been a collapse, because any collapse of one floor onto another and so forth would have required in the vicinity of 96 seconds, and yet according to the official account and from timing of the demolition of the towers, we find it's occurring in about 10 seconds apiece. In fact, according to the 9/11 Commission report, they assign 9 seconds to one and 11 to the other, so that, you know, even the simplest considerations show that a collapse is preposterous. Judy has also made the point, which I had confirmed by Father Frank Morales from St. Mark's Episcopal Church in the immediate vicinity, who was a first responder, that those buildings were converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust, where what we expect if a collapse takes place, as in the case of Building 7, which came down at 5:20 in the afternoon in what appears to be a classic controlled demolition, which is well illustrated in the brief video entitled "This Is an Orange," produced by Anthony Lawson, which I consider to be quite brilliant. There was a stack of pancakes. All those floors collapsed, came down at the same time, and there was a stack of pancakes or debris, mostly floors, that's equal to about 12% of the height of the original structure, which is what has been discovered empirically to occur during controlled demolitions. So that it was a 47-story building originally, and we wound up with something over 5 floors worth of debris. But when the Twin Towers were destroyed, all the floors remained stationary. And when it was done, they were destroyed below ground level, as Father Frank reported twice during interviews, in which in some photographs you can see relatively easily. There's one taken downward toward Building 6, which had this huge gaping hole in the center, where just beyond Building 6 is the residue of the North Tower, where you can see that there's essentially no debris at all, and yet just to the left you can see the massive stack of debris from Building 7. Well, since the Twin Towers were 110 stories, whereas Building 7 was only 47, they should have had more than twice the size of the debris pile. So it should have been, you know, 11, 12, 13 floors.
Yeah.
But instead destroyed really below ground level.
I think one of the most startling pieces of evidence concerning that issue is how there happened to be people in one of the lower stairwells who actually survived the event. And they said, you know, then they looked up when it was over and there was air above them and sky. But hadn't been 100 stories falling down on top of them. Instead, they you know, it just opened up the sky above them and they could see out.
Yeah, I think the fact that we're dealing with some kind of unusual, unexpected, even exotic technology is demonstrated by the fact that even visual inspection confirms that what we're witnessing or what took place was the conversion of two 500,000-ton buildings, principally made of steel and concrete, into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust, where, Christopher, it appears as though it was necessary to destroy them using this novel technique in order to ensure that no significant portion of either building came down into the bathtub, which is the term used for a moat or dike that was built within which the towers were constructed to keep Hudson River water out. Because if the bathtub had shattered, then the Hudson River would have flooded beneath Lower Manhattan, the most valuable real estate in the world, into the subway and PATH train tunnels. It would have been a disaster of enormously greater proportions than what actually occurred, which, of course, we would all agree was bad enough. But it appears that there was a great deal of consideration given to not doing more damage to this very valuable real estate than was necessary to destroy the Twin Towers, which incidentally were laden with asbestos and represented a huge problem. There were shortages with occupancy, with tenancy. Larry Silverstein remarkably invested about $114 million into their purchase the first time they'd been transferred into private hands, and immediately insured them against terrorist attack. And because there were allegedly two airplanes involved, claimed double indemnity and actually collected over $4.4 billion on his $114 million investment. Not for nothing is he known as Lucky Larry.
Yes, I could think of some other terms, but So the Vancouver conference is, as I see from the schedule, it's looking at the role of nanothermite, it's looking at the possibility of mini nukes, it's looking at directed energy weapons. And that's just one area that it's going to give a broader view on. Because there's then all materials considering the Pentagon more deeply, and then the whole, the emerging evidence concerning media duplicity in the whole event in terms of faked airplanes and the belief among a growing number of researchers that they weren't real airplanes slipping into those towers and that the event was actually scripted by the media. So this is another, I think, major... It's like a new generation, a bit, of 9/11 research. It's a whole nother level, I think, showing the psyop nature of the event.
Joshua Blakeney, with whom I'm organizing this event and who had authored, he was a participant at the Vancouver hearings, who authored an article entitled The Pros and Cons of the Vancouver Hearings, which you can find at the bottom of the page. And subsequently, I authored a sequel entitled The Science and Politics of 9/11, the Toronto Hearings. In both cases, what we are doing, as you are correctly observing, is carrying the level of research forward. In fact, Joshua has suggested that you might compare them by suggesting that the Toronto hearings were the introductory course, and what we have in Vancouver is the graduate seminar.
Yeah. I think that's a good analogy, because it still leaves so much unexplained, like so many phenomena and peculiarities. It's funny, I met Richard Gage once when he was in Ottawa, and it shocked me a bit when I raised the no-plane issue with him, and it's like he didn't even want to discuss it, and it's like the architects and engineers, they have this whole argument about controlled demolitions and the use of nanothermite, and that's all good and valuable, but why does that mean they kind of stop there? Why aren't they looking at the dynamics of these aluminum airplanes slipping into those buildings without any slowdown in their motion and no resistance? Like, do they conceive that to be possible as architects and engineers? But it's like they won't even consider that, and which made me suspect. It's like they're gatekeepers in a way. They want the focus on this argument, but they are not willing to, like this, if it's video fakery, it raises the whole issue of the media's participation in the event. I mean, it just puts it on a whole new basis, I think.
Well,
Have you ever talked to Richard Gage about the no airplane theory?
I believe I sent him a link to the article about it, as I did to David Ray Griffin and to many others. I have no doubt they're well aware of it at this point, Christopher, because mm-hmm. a development like that travels, you know, faster than wildfire through the 9/11 community, because unlike fires being promoted by wind, you know, electronic communications are virtually instantaneous. Now, I have a complete agreement with you that it seems as though politics was placed ahead of science. In fact, you could say that is very much the theme of what Joshua had to say about the Toronto hearings and what I had to say in addition, that they were really concerned to make a very conservative appeal. They sought to justify it by claiming they were offering the best evidence, and therefore did not want to deal with the other more controversial issues. But my point is, we're never going to overcome the factions within the movement if we don't address the issues that divide us, and that there's no point in having a conference that is only going to extol the conventional wisdom. What we need are conferences that bring together experts on different aspects of the case, even experts on different theories about how, for example, the destruction of the Twin Towers was done, in order to explore and evaluate the evidence to determine which, using objective scientific criteria to determine the strength of the evidential support that those theories receive from the available evidence, in order to try to arbitrate some of these differences and resolve them. So I completely agree with you in believing that the Vancouver hearings, which drew international attention, actually fell far short of its intended goals.
And then the conference in Vancouver will even have a concluding section looking at, like, different theories of who was behind it and the politics and such of it. So that's a profound addition. It's going to be an amazing conference, and for listeners who are unaware, I'm going to be one of the presenters at the conference and presenting on my article on fabled airplanes and scripted witness. And so it's going to be an exciting time in Vancouver this summer. So, Jim, it was 9/11 Vancouver 9/11 hearings.
No, 9/11Vancouverhearings.com, Christopher.
Okay,
9/11Vancouverhearings gives you an introduction, the motivation, what we're trying to do in comparing, putting alternative theories to the test is the theme of our conference. And we explain what we do. I offer recommended readings. Then you can review the program. You can read an open article that Joshua Blake and Kevin Barrett and I addressed to the 9/11 community, and then my critique of the Vancouver hearings, followed by Joshua. So actually, anyone who doesn't know a lot about 9/11 can actually acquire a fairly good orientation of the major issues related to 9/11 research by simply visiting 9/11Vancouverhearings.com.
Yeah, excellent. And you have an excellent article up there yourself on the issue of the airplanes. And
okay, yeah, so Christopher, I appreciate your mentioning that. It seems to me that the most controversial issue within 9/11 research, which, as you observe, Richard Gage wouldn't even want to admit as a question, has to do with the different crash sites and the fact that there is no evidence that planes crashed, that real planes crashed at any of them, but that various forms of fabrication of evidence and visual or video fakery were taking place. And it seems to me this is so extraordinary, and it goes so far to pull the rug out from under the official account, that it may be the single most explosive issue that has the potential to capture the mind of the public. Because once they realize the extent to which the government has been faking 9/11, and we have been able to disprove it, I believe the public should open its mind to the realization that this was a case of the use of terror, of violence and threats of violence to instill fear into the minds of the American public in order to manipulate us for political reasons to promote a political agenda of the Bush-Cheney administration, an agenda that was well laid out by Project for the New American Century, many of whose supporters had become prominent members of the Department of Defense, in order to justify a reversal in American foreign policy where we had never in the past attacked any country that had never attacked us, but now we would begin to launch a series of wars of aggression against Afghanistan, Iraq. Eventually, we'd participate in the use of NATO, which was formed as a collective defense organization, against Libya. And now, of course, we're hearing all this talk about attacking Iran, which would be a catastrophe of the greatest magnitude, Christopher. Not only has Iran not attacked any other country for more than 300 years, Iran has signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran has allowed inspectors in to visit its facilities. Iran is committed to the peaceful use of nuclear energy. In fact, its slogan is nuclear energy for all, nuclear weapons for none. And yet we have the Israeli prime minister, the leader of a nation that has 200 to 600 of these little beauties, that has not signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, that will not allow inspectors into its country, as the leading cheerleader of attacks on Iran, who has come to the United States to try to induce the American military and our own president into taking steps to attack Iran ourselves or to support Israel in doing so, which is not only completely unjustifiable on the basis of the facts of the matter, Christopher, but also would violate conventions and peace treaties that date back to 1899, the Hague Convention, in 1928, the Kellogg-Briand Peace Treaty, the founding of the United Nations in 47-48, where the United Nations Charter declares that nations are obligated to resolve their differences through peaceful negotiation. So that since these treaties have the same status under our Constitution as the Constitution itself, we have a president and a series of candidates for the Republican nomination who are, in their case, the GOP candidates, advocating a first strike, which would violate all of these treaties and therefore the Constitution, which if they were successful in attaining the nomination, they would be taking a solemn oath to preserve, protect, and defend it. And here Barack Obama, I think, is doing his best to negotiate a very delicate political tightrope by wanting to assure Jewish Americans that the United States is unwavering in its support for Israel without encouraging Benjamin Netanyahu, whom some now regard as a madman, in initiating a war that would be has been estimated to bring about the deaths of 1 million Iranians outright. And then as the contamination cloud swept across Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India, another 35 million premature deaths. And I say, who is this man, Benjamin Netanyahu, to make a decision that would bring about the outright or premature deaths of 36 million people? These are human beings. We hear a great deal about the Holocaust, Christopher, where it appears to be the case that the number of Holocaust victims has been exaggerated. 6 million is commonly claimed, but I doubt there were 6 million Jews in all of Europe. Even if we reduce that to 2 million, or even take 6 million, we're talking about six times that many deaths that would accrue from an attack on Iran to be made by the prime minister of Israel. I say that is outrageous. It is morally corrupt. It is intellectually bankrupt. It has no standing under the law. And in my opinion, it's shocking that we should have any candidate for the highest office of our country who would endorse a first strike on Iran in violation of international law in the United States Constitution.
And it would be a war completely based on lies and propaganda and public deception, as are all of these wars. The media themselves, they violate UN Charter 25, which I understand call it a crime against peace for media to misrepresent events and propagate war propaganda. So the media are all complicit in deceiving the public as to the what's really going on in these situations. It's just terrible, and you know, Netanyahu is in Ottawa this weekend. I'm going to be on Parliament Hill tomorrow with hopefully thousands of others protesting what's being done and the closeness of the Canadian now. Canadian government seems completely consumed under this Israeli Zionist agenda. It's really quite disturbing that we might get involved in
another criminal war. You're absolutely right. And the evidence of media complicity here is overwhelming. For example, the BBC, one of the most respected news organizations in the world, came here to my home near Madison, Wisconsin, and for their first documentary on 9/11, interviewed me for 8 hours, Christopher.
Wow.
They wound up using 7.5 minutes of me, 4 minutes of Alex Jones, and 3.5 minutes of Dylan Avery. Where Dylan Avery was supposed to be, you know, the young punk, Alex Jones, the messianic preacher, and I, the kooky professor. And then when they wanted to do it again, a second documentary, I explained to the producer, Michael Rudin, that I had not been impressed with the way they'd done it the first time, but that if they wanted to tell the real story, I'd be glad to participate. They came here and interviewed me for 4 more hours before they produced their second Conspiracy Files documentary. And what they did as a clever form of deception, a sleight of hand, Christopher, was when I would be talking to them about one photograph, about, for example, the original hit point and the lack of debris and how you can see these lime green civilian fire trucks extinguishing the fires and there's no debris on the lawn whatsoever, which is preposterous if a 100-ton Boeing aircraft had actually crashed there. They instead, when I was talking about the absence of debris, used photographs that showed debris which started to appear later, which I actually believe had to have been dropped from a C-130 that was circling the Pentagon because it would have been too awkward, public, and embarrassing to have enlisted men and officers carrying debris out onto the lawn, but having it come down gradually from the air would be a perfect way to deliver it. It's just they were late in getting the debris onto the ground so that the damage to the lawn and so forth that should have been present was not present. They also, when I identified the hit point, which is about 10 feet high, 16, 17 feet wide, there's chain link fence, a couple of automobiles, two enormous spools of cable, unbroken windows, they switched again to a different photograph of a different location on the building on the second floor. So they were doing a very clever substitution of photographs to make it appear as though I did not know what I was talking about, which I have now documented in an article on Veterans Today entitled "The BBC's Instrument of 9/11 Misinformation." And, of course, misinformation is false information, but when it's deliberately disseminated with the intention of misleading or deceiving the audience, it is also properly qualified as disinformation, where I have actually published articles about these concepts themselves for the sake of attaining philosophical clarity.
Would you also consider it, would it not be called the obstruction of justice?
Yes, it would, I mean, Christopher. That's a very nice point.
It clearly is. You know, and also accessory after the fact to mass murder.
Yes.
And obstruction of justice. It's pretty serious criminal charges against.
Well, they are, especially when you're talking about the deaths of some 3,000, you know, civilians. I mean, it's a serious crime. And therefore, then, I believe this article to which you invite attention, 9/11 planes, no planes, and video fakery, is a particularly important contribution to 9/11 research, because here I'm providing documentary and witness and video and photographic evidence that all four of the crash sites appear to have been faked or fabricated one way or another. And it's really quite stunning when you put it all together. So I took great pains here, Christopher, in bringing the relevant evidence together in one place to lay out the scenario well in advance of the Vancouver hearings, because I wanted everyone to understand why this is such an important issue with the potential to explode into the public consciousness. Because I think that the fact that no plane actually hit the Pentagon, our nation's military command and control center, on the one hand, and that the plane hits on the North and the South Tower in New York were faked one way or another, have more potential to convince the public that 9/11 was an inside job than all of the repetitions of Building 7 and all of the discussion of nanothermite put together.
Yeah, well, I mean, to me, those, seeing the manner in which buildings come down, when you consider it, to me, is 100% proof that they didn't collapse due to airplanes, just in the observation of that evidence alone. But this reveals a whole nother level of involvement of the media and the kind of PSYOP community. I mean, this was a huge psychological operation perpetrated against the American people. And in regards to, like, the why it was done, you know, I think we have to realize there are multiple reasons. You know, they wanted to destroy criminal evidences in Building 7. They wanted to destroy the naval accounting accounts in the Pentagon, which lost $2.4 billion, I think it was. They wanted to get rid of the towers. Like, there's multiple motives in how it was perpetrated and those specific targets. So it's a complex situation. Sorry, Jim?
Yes, and if I might add on that, the suggestion has been made, wouldn't it be simpler to fly real planes into the building rather than fake them? And the answer turns out to be no, somewhat surprisingly, for three different reasons. Number one, it's very difficult to hit an edifice only 208 feet wide with an aircraft going, well, purportedly over 500 miles an hour. Now, it turns out that actually is an aerodynamically impossible speed at that altitude. But members of Pilots for 9/11 Truth in the aftermath of these events sought to simulate the attacks on the Twin Towers, and there were at least 20 efforts to do it with only one hit on the building out of the 20. So it's very difficult to hit the building with a high-speed commercial carrier. Number two, they needed to get the planes all the way into the building before they exploded in order to have a pseudo-justification for the purported collapse of the buildings. No real plane could do that. The intricate structure of the building was such that in the case of the hit on the North Tower, for example, a real plane would at the angle of impact would have been intersecting with seven different floors consisting of steel trusses filled with 4 to 8 inches of concrete, each of which therefore represented over an acre of concrete. In the case of the South Tower, 8 of those floors, which would have posed enormous horizontal resistance. So the plane, you know, where those trusses were connected to the core columns at one end and to the external steel support columns on the other, and where they would have crumpled when they impacted with the building in those 8 floors, their wings would have broken off, the tail, body seats, and luggage would have fallen to the ground. Some of their parts, such as the engines, would no doubt have entered the building, but none of this happened. In fact, the fuel would have blown apart too, and they would have exploded on impact. Instead, they had to get them all the way inside the building, which they could not do with any real aircraft before the fuel would blow up, to create the pseudo explanation of the fires causing the steel to weaken, leading to the collapse. And they also had a timing problem, Christopher. There were explosions set up in the sub-basements of both the North and the South Towers that were designed to drain the sprinkler systems of water, because otherwise the very modest fires that remained after those spectacular fireballs consumed virtually all of the jet fuel in the first 10 or 15 seconds would have easily extinguished what fires remained. In fact, the National Institute of Standards and Technology actually studied 236 samples of steel from the buildings and discovered 233 had not been exposed to temperatures above 500 degrees Fahrenheit, which is the temperature of an ordinary office fire, and the other three not above 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit. So those fires would have been easily manageable had there been water in the sprinkler system. And what they wanted to do then to explain away the explosions in the sub-basement was to maintain that jet fuel from the planes had fallen through the elevator shafts down into the sub-basements where it had exploded. Now, that was a far-fetched theory in the first place, because the principal elevators in those buildings are staggered. So you come down 30 floors, you have to get off, go down another 30, get off, go down another 30. So there was very little in the way of access to the sub-basement. There were two maintenance elevators that went all the way from the top to the bottom. But in the North Tower, for example, where William Rodriguez, who was the senior custodian, reported the massive explosion in the sub-basements before there were any reverberations from the purported plane impact on the North Tower, observed that one of his fellow custodians was one in one of those maintenance elevators, and if jet fuel had fallen through it, he would have been killed, but he actually survived. So it appears that they had to coordinate temporally the hits on the building with these explosions in the sub-basements, but where they nevertheless committed the blunder of not sufficiently closely timing the impact so that the explosions in the sub-basement actually went off 14 and 17 seconds prior to any reverberations from the alleged impacts, which Gordon Ross and Craig Furlong have explored in great detail. They compared very accurate seismological data from Lamont Laboratory run by Columbia University to determine the time of the explosions, and then very precise radar and FAA data about when the planes allegedly hit the building, and they determined those 14 and 17 second premature explosions, which obviously those 19 Islamic terrorists could not possibly have been able to arrange. So we have an awful lot of evidence about why they had to fake the plane impacts, how it was done, and the hopeless inadequacy of the explanations they've tried to advance for them.
And exactly as you say, they couldn't have used real planes because real planes couldn't possibly have penetrated the building in the manner they needed to establish their story. I mean, they would have bounced off. And you mentioned the angle of impact of one or both of the planes, in fact, had a fairly sharp angle of impact. So they likely would have just deflected it, even though, as you say, the engines might have carried forward and penetrated the buildings. But certainly the tail and the wings and those major aluminum structures wouldn't have penetrated those floor trusses. There's absolutely no doubt of that. So indeed, they had to use faked airplanes.
That's exactly right, Christopher. Not only that, but there was an engine component found at Church and Murray that was allegedly from the South Tower hit by Flight 175. Now, both the South Tower and the North Tower planes were Boeing 767s, whereas both of the planes that purportedly hit in Shanksville and the Pentagon were 757s. But the engine found at Church and Murray, which was under a steel scaffolding, was sitting on a sidewalk that showed no shattering from having been impacted at high speed by a massive object, was not even from a 767. And indeed, Jack White, who is a legendary photo analyst from JFK who turned his attention to 9/11 studies, discovered Fox video footage showing a white van at that intersection with individuals wearing FBI vests offloading something very heavy. So it appears as though that engine component was planted. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just as in case of other aspects of the situation where they didn't know enough to get things right, they put the wrong kind of engine component, which simply reinforces the fabrication of the evidence and does not remotely support the official account, even though it was meant to do so.
Yeah, I've seen the pictures of that. It looks funny sitting under that scaffolding. I didn't know, was the scaffolding supposed to have been constructed afterwards to keep people away, or was that?
No, it was in existence before. I think they must have just somehow thought it was a good location. You know, it's one of those cases of not thinking things through, not knowing well enough what you're doing. Those who are involved in this stuff weren't rocket scientists, Christopher. A lot of them really had only a feeble understanding of aerodynamics, for example, or physics. I mean, if you go to the article, 9/11 planes, no planes in video fakery, the first image you see shows the plane half into the building, and there's no evidence of any collision, which means what's taking place here is in violation of Newton's laws. It should have crumpled. There should have been massive resistance by the building. There are some who say that it's a faulty analogy to talk about the plane impacting with a 500,000-ton building because it's only hitting a part of the building. But the blunder involved there, Christopher, is like comparing a stack of coins. Suppose you have a stack of 50-cent pieces and on top of that 25-cent pieces and then nickels and then dimes. if you were to hit it just right with a knife, for example, you might be able to knock one of the nickels out and the rest would remain in place. But now consider the same stack of coins welded together. If you try to knock one out, you're actually impacting with the entire weight of the accumulation of those coins welded together. And that's the proper analogy. Some have even suggested that if the plane was traveling really, really fast, it could have penetrated the building. But that's no more plausible than to say that an automobile that collides with a massive tree would have passed through it if only it had been traveling really, really fast.
Yeah, really. That's a good analogy. Yeah, it couldn't possibly have penetrated in that way. Material science demonstrates it's an impossibility.
We're talking about an empty aluminum beer can really basically running up something like a stone wall. It's not, sometimes a comparison has been made with a bullet, but these aircraft are not bullets. These aircraft are basically hollow shells made of aluminum. A bullet is a dense object that travels far faster, more than twice as fast as these airplanes are purported to be traveling. And, you know, the comparison is simply completely, totally flawed. Also, some have brought up the Sandia test of a fighter jet that was strapped to a railway trestle and run into, at 500 miles an hour, a nuclear-resistant concrete bunker. Well, the plane flies into a million little pieces. And, of course, its velocity comes to zero. It stops. No part of the plane passes through that massive nuclear-resistant concrete bunker. But here we have just the opposite. The plane not only does not fly into a million pieces, but it passes effortlessly through the side of this massive 500,000-ton building without any reduction in its speed at all. In fact, Christopher, one of the most stunning proofs, and the one that actually convinced me that we had to be dealing with some kind of video fakery, where video fakery is any use of video to convey a false impression of events. It doesn't necessarily require that the videos, the strips of film themselves, be altered, but would include filming fake aircraft and then presenting them as though they were real, which appears to be what happened here. And in the case of the Naudé brothers' footage of the Flight 11 hitting the North Tower, what we have is the plane passes through its entire length into the building in the same number of frames it passes through its own length in air. We have found this in both the Hezer Connie and in the Evan Fairbanks video, which is taken right from the base straight up. Those are obviously preposterous, impossible events unless a massive 500,000-ton building poses no more resistance to the trajectory of an aircraft than air. So I think that even the most, you know, elementary student, it doesn't take more than 10th grade physics to understand that what we're viewing is an impossibility and therefore that we must be contemplating some form of video fakery.
And I think the even better evidence of that is what's called the nose out shot, which was shot from the helicopter, where you see the plane appear on the television screen for about 1 to 2 seconds coming in from the right side, and you see it pass through the building, so it actually sticks its nose out the other end of the tower, as though the plane went through the whole tower and its nose stuck out. And I know in Edward Hendry's new book, and we have Edward coming up in a few minutes, he even has a picture of that side of the tower where that nose of the airplane was supposed to have stuck out. And you can see there's no breakage in the basic metallic structure on the coating of that building. Yeah, have you seen that picture, Jim?
Yes. Simon Shack featured it prominently in his series entitled September Clues.
That nose out shot shows exactly what you're saying about it completely violates the laws of physics, the speed of these airplanes entering into the building or passing through it. Yeah, it's a total impossibility. So,
and the nose of an aircraft, as you know, these commercial carriers, is the most fragile part. It's loaded with electronics, and you know, it would be the part that would be initially completely smashed and destroyed. There's no possibility a plane could hit a building like this and then emerge at the other side in the first place, much less with its nose intact.
One thing very interesting. I heard you on a show a couple of weeks ago. That's how I made contact with you again. And I know you had one caller call in, and I thought he was a disinfo agent, but he said he was kind of across the river, and a whole bunch of people saw an airplane fly into the tower. And your response to him, well, partly what's mentioned was the idea of the airplane being a hologram. Now, most people don't really know what a hologram is, and I don't think they are understanding really what you're suggesting. Now, I'd like to try to summarize of what I thought your response was. You said, like, we have to begin with the fact that airplanes couldn't possibly have penetrated the buildings in that manner, and they couldn't have been airplanes. So if people did legitimately think that they saw an airplane, it had to be something else. For instance, perhaps a fly-by airplane like we had at the Pentagon, or it could have been a hologram. So you could have created the visual illusion of airplanes. Now, but you're not saying, to the public here I'm saying this, you're not saying that the hologram created the hole in the building. Like, that's not the point of what you're saying. What you're saying is if there were legitimate witnesses who viewed an airplane, that's one of the possibilities to account for that evidence is. Now, am I correct in that, Jim, do you think?
Yeah, you're exactly correct, Christopher. I mean, there are three alternatives. What we have are what appear to be planes that are performing feats that no real plane could perform, such as traveling faster than is aerodynamically possible for a Boeing 767, entering the building in violation of Newton's laws, passing through its whole length into the building in the same number of frames it passes through its own length in air. Actually, the plane 175 also does not have any strobe lights, as John Lear, our nation's most distinguished pilot, observed. And as Ben Collette, a 9/11 activist from Seattle, also noticed, the plane casts no shadow. In fact, there's some videos that I include here on this article at the end that show the plane's wings disappear, its left wing disappears in some of the shots. Well, obviously, that would be preposterous if it were a real plane. So that we have three possibilities to explain what's going on here, two of which involve altering the film after it was shot, presumably with no plane present, which include computer-generated images and what's known as video compositing. And I have illustrations of those different techniques in other videos here toward the end of the article. But if you take seriously the witness reports claiming they saw a plane, meaning they saw what they took to be a plane, even though it was performing feats that no real plane could perform, then it had to be something that looked like a plane, but nevertheless was not a real plane because no real plane could do the feats that were attributed to this. Now, we have videos you can find online of a featured speaker coming out to address an audience about, say, a matter of business or what have you, and he makes his whole presentation, and then it turns out he's a hologram. These holograms can be very sophisticated. And in fact, when I began to contemplate the possibility that it could have been a projected image that looked like a plane, was performing feats no real plane could perform, but where, as you're remarking, the cutouts in the sides of the walls had to be created, by a separate causal mechanisms, by some arrangement of explosives, for example, to create those cookie-cutter-like cutouts. But it can't have been a real plane. But as long as you give weight to witnesses who said they saw what they took to be a real plane, then it seems to me that the only theory among the three, computer-generated images, video compositing, and holograms, that can accommodate all of the evidence, including the witness reports, is a hologram. And, of course, we know that the military technology is 20 or 30 years ahead of what the public knows. When we have so many forms of sophisticated hologram technology that we do know about, it's not surprising that there could be an additional one. And, in fact, we have anecdotal evidence of persons who are, say, driving out in the desert in California when a huge cargo plane came up behind them and then suddenly disappeared. Well, that clearly was a hologram they were witnessing, just as we have here an apparent plane, but it disappears completely into the building in violation of Newton's laws. Well, Newton's laws cannot be violated by any real physical object, so this had to be the image of an object and not a real plane. That's the argument.
Yeah. And there is reportedly evidence of various witnesses who were right below the South Tower and said they saw no airplane. So we know that there is some evidence on that side.
I think that's true, and that it could be that with a holographic projection, depending where you were, you might or might not be able to see it.
Yes.
I interviewed a fellow named Scott Forbes who'd actually worked in the South Tower for 3 years prior to 9/11, who was home that Tuesday because he'd been working to restore the use of their computers after a power outage that had occurred unexpectedly that weekend, who was called by a colleague who told him, take a look at the building. He opened his window and he said he had a perfect view of the South Tower. He said he saw the plane approach the building, and then he was simply astonished that the building just ate the plane, meaning the building just swallowed up the plane, which seems to me, and I interviewed him on The Real Deal. You can find his interview at radiofetzer.blogspot.com. Scott Forbes, you can listen to his interview. He seemed perfectly sincere and genuine to me. So if you accept that anyone, any witness, saw what they took to be a real plane, it doesn't mean it was a real plane, but it does mean they saw something that looked to them as though it were a real plane. And then you have to fit that in with the rest of the evidence, including the performance of feats that no real plane could perform. And when you realize they had a timing problem, they had an entry problem, they had a hit-the-target problem, you begin to realize why they had to fake it. They really had no other choice.
Yeah, excellent. You also, in your article, you had a very interesting picture, which was of a time-lapse presentation of the airplane hitting the first tower, the North Tower. And I gather that's what that picture, you know the one I'm referring to, Jim?
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
It looks like a blob or something, like it doesn't it doesn't look like a real airplane.
Well, Rosalie Grable, who was among the first to take seriously the possibility something was funny about these videos, prepared that time sequence, and she's referred to it as a flying what's-it. Her best conjecture, which is supported by the two comparison frames just below it, is that it was an arrangement of four unmanned aerial vehicles. And when you look at that left-hand photograph just below the time sequence, you see where there seem to be like four impacts on the building that create the image of a Z for four points of the Z. And yet after the smoke clears, it's turned into an elongated V. Well, that's obviously preposterous. Something was going on there, which is, again, the management of the cookie-cutter-like cutouts. And we have a lot more evidence to substantiate that. But it appears that the two planes, Flight 11 hitting the North Tower and Flight 175 the South, were fabricated or faked, but in very different ways. I think it was important to them to do it in different ways so no one would be able to figure out that there was a pattern here of deception.
One other issue, we had the live coverage of the event, but then what we had was a series of amateur videos turned in from the street where we see some of the obvious digital fakery, those of the airplanes where the wings disappear before they've entered the building and similar things. Now, my expectation is that they had Or my thought is that they had people on the street who knew the approximate timing of the explosions in the building, so they had them film the explosions of the building so that they subsequently, all they had to do was impose digital airplanes over what actually occurred. Have you thought about that? Is that kind of how you tend to see the amateur?
Well, I mean, you know, to impose it over means that they were using computer-generated images or video compositing, where I'm inclined to believe that we have authentic videos but of fake planes. So that we have, you know, instead of Flight 11, which was supposed to be a Boeing 767, we have this arrangement of unmanned aerial vehicles. Instead of Flight 175, another Boeing 767, we have this hologram. so that we're actually seeing things, but the things we're seeing we're interpreting as planes, but they in fact aren't actually real planes, and that that's how it was done. And I think that the evidence is more supportive of the hologram and fakery hypothesis. Well, Leslie Raphael, by the way, a Scottish student of 9/11, has published a brilliant piece entitled The Naudé Brothers Film Was Faked, where he explains that in order for that film crew to have been present at just that location, it required satisfying about 100 highly improbable coincidental circumstances, so the cameraman could sort of effortlessly sweep up and capture the hit on the building. I mean, remember, sound goes slower than the flight of the plane, so if you're hearing the sound and responding to it, you should be looking up behind where the plane was, at least initially, and only later compensating for the fact that sound is slower than the flight. But in this case, that didn't happen. He simply effortlessly swung his camera up and captured this out-of-focus image, and I even believe that its being out-of-focus was quite deliberate, so you couldn't see more clearly exactly what was going on, or it would have given the game away.
Yeah. Well, fascinating. It's a mystery inside, an enigma inside a riddle. We're two halfway in our program, and I think I'm going to just take a moment and bring our second guest in to join Jim and I. And I'm assuming at the moment that Edward Hendry is on with us. And Edward has published a fascinating book of 9/11 research. It's called 9/11 Enemies, Foreign and Domestic. Secret evidence censored from the official record proves traitors aided Israel in attacking the USA. And Edward was on my show a month or so ago, and I hope he's there now. Are you with us, Edward? Oh. Okay, well, he's not quite yet.
It's a marvelous book. I have read the book. I have it right here at hand. And it's a marvelous book. I mean, in relatively brief compass. I mean, the book is, let me see exactly how many pages. It's 303 pages. It provides a comprehensive assessment of the events at all the locations we're talking about, Shanksville, the Pentagon, and New York City. And it's very thoroughgoing and addresses all the important issues, including who was involved, who was responsible, and why.
Yeah, there was some really very excellent new evidences. For me, there was when I read it. Edward, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome. Jim and I are both praising your book.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Have you been able to be listening in on Jim and I through the show so far?
Yes, I have. I get excellent reception.
Maybe I'll let you say hello to Jim. I don't know if
well, it's an honor. It's an honor to be on the air with Jim. He has an encyclopedic knowledge of 9/11, and I'm very impressed just listening to your conversation with him and his recall of the details and the facts and all of the, that's involved in the cover up. Very much humbled to be included in this conversation.
Well, you've done so much good work, Edward. I'm really pleased to have you here. I thought Christopher had a great idea of having the two of us on together, and I welcome your picking up with him for a while, and I'd enjoy listening to the two of you for a while, and then I'll come back in.
Okay.
Yeah, so, Edward, maybe we can give you the floor to just respond to any of the subjects that Jim and I've touched on, and then maybe bring in some. I know there were some things you had mentioned previously that I'd asked, I especially had wanted you to bring up again, but we'll come to those. So I'll give you the floor, Edward.
Okay. Well, I think what you've been discussing, for the most part, is the fact that the evidence suggests there were no planes. And if you step back and look at the evidence objectively, that's really the only conclusion you can come to. Those behind the conspiracy have to keep a lid on that. Because if the general public becomes aware that there were no planes, then that will lead to some other conclusions that they have to at all that they have to guard against. Because if there were no planes, that implicates the media. And if the media is implicated, then what we have here is a massive conspiracy that spans not only people within the government, but outside the government, that there is a cooperative conspiracy, that the group that is controlling this event controls not only the military and civilian arms of government, but also the media. And in fact, if you stop and think about it, this could only be done if the media were in the pockets of the conspirators. And the fact that there were no planes really points directly at the media as being part and parcel of the conspiracy. They could not pull it off without media involvement if they had no planes.
Let me just add a couple points here to substantiate what you're suggesting, because many in the audience may be floored by the suggestion that there could have been no planes. I mean, if there are no planes, then there are no hijackers. If there are no hijackers, there are no passengers, and there were no suicide attacks, and therefore, of course, the wars of aggression in Afghanistan, Iraq, and all that are completely and hopelessly unjustifiable. In fact, Elias Davidson, who's a very thorough and meticulous scholar, has published on the fact that the government has never been able to prove that any of those alleged hijackers were aboard any of those planes, where, in fact, we know from, for example, David Ray Griffin in his book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, that six or seven of the alleged hijackers turned up alive and well in the days after, several of which were interviewed by British news institutions. Second of all, David Griffin himself has built on the prior research of A.K. Dewdney from Western Ontario University, who flew around with three different types of cell phones and discovered that at speeds above 200 miles an hour and altitudes above 2,000 feet, they become increasingly unreliable because the microwave relay stations can't switch the messages from one to another fast enough. And indeed, putting together that consideration with the fact that the 757s that were allegedly used in Shanksville and the Pentagon did not have airphones, and we get quite a convincing case on which he has published that all of those phone calls were faked. I'd also like to mention that Colonel George Nelson, U.S. Air Force retired and air crash investigation expert, has observed that although there are millions of uniquely identifiable component parts from those four aircraft, the government has yet to produce even one. All of which, as you are observing, tends to substantiate the conclusion that there's a massive evidence that there may have been no planes. Now, I would add that recent work by Pilots for 9/11 Truth has established that although we know from Bureau of Transportation statistics data that in Flight 11 and 77 were not even scheduled to fly that day, as Gerard Holmgren, a brilliant blues musician from Australia, discovered almost immediately. Pilots for 9/11 Truth has now discovered that Flight 93 was in the air, but it was over Champaign-Urbana at the time it was allegedly crashing in Shanksville. And Flight 175 was in the air, but it was over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania at the time it was allegedly crashing into the towers. Wow. Which means it would seem to me to be impossible to deny that there must be some kind of fakery going on in New York, since no single aircraft can be in two places at the same time, which Pilots has now copiously documented based upon communications between the ground and the aircraft that were taking place those days.
Yes, we have eyewitnesses on the scene that have come out and stated emphatically, in fact, in court documents, April Gallup being one example, where she was in the Pentagon in close proximity to the blast zone. I don't call it an impact zone because I don't believe that there was an impact. I believe that the evidence would suggest that there were pre-planted explosives. What most people don't realize is that that section of the Pentagon was under renovation. And that was the day upon which the renovation was complete, was September 11th. And that's the perfect cover to plant explosives. She was in close proximity to the blast. She was able to get out with her child, saw no indication of any planes. There were no seats. There was no luggage. There was no landing gear. There was no fuselage. There was nothing to indicate a plane was anywhere near that area. And she walked right out the area that the plane allegedly impacted the Pentagon.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
She has filed suit and stated such.
And you were making the broader point also, Edward, that like the fact of the media's complicity in faking the airplanes, and especially I'm thinking of the airplane hitting the South Tower. Like none of the other airplanes, are there any footage of them? But at least the airplane hitting the South Tower, people think there was all kinds of live coverage and amateur videos of it, and they've seen all these different images of it. So that was the one plane for which there did seem to have been more substantial evidence.
Well, let's look at the eyewitness accounts. But before we get into the eyewitness accounts, okay, let's talk about the implications of media involvement. Jim's quite aware of, I'm sure, with regard to the Kennedy assassination, Dan Rather's broadcast where he is narrating what happened on the Zapruder film. And in his narration, he falsely indicates that Kennedy's head shot forward very violently. And it wasn't until years later when the Zapruder film was finally released that it was revealed that, in fact, he was lying.
There's an irony here. We have done so much work on the Zapruder film. I believe now that the most competent experts on the film, who all agree that it has been revised, to remove a limousine stop in particular, during which JFK was hit twice in the head, where he appears to have been hit in the back of the head and fallen forward, as Dan Rather described. Then Jackie eased him back up, and he was hit in the right temple by a frangible exploding bullet that blew about half his brains out the back of his head to the left rear, where they hit motorcycle officer Bobby Hargis so hard that he thought he himself had been shot. So then, ironically, I think it turns out that what Dan Rather was telling was the truth, and that it was the revised Zapruder film that did not show what he said, so that he has taken a bad rap, when in fact I would suggest that the latest research on this question supports what he was actually describing.
Well, the thing is, was he looking at an unredacted, unedited Zapruder film that has not been released to the public? Or was he looking at the redacted version that we saw? Because if he's
No, the redacting took place over the weekend. They had to take it back to Kodak. It was done at Hawkeye Works at Kodak headquarters in New York and Rochester. Dan Rather was reviewing what appears to have been, the original Zapruder film, where there are at least a half a dozen others, by the way, Edward, who have actually seen what appears to be the same, as you call it, unredacted version of the film.
I've read some of the work that you've done and some of the other experts in photography and motion pictures with regard to and the witness testimony with regard to the vehicle in it, and from my understanding in researching this, the vehicle came to an almost complete stop,
came to a complete stop that lasted 3 to 4 seconds. Yeah,
right. And you can actually see the Secret Service agents in the background. In one photograph where they're actually getting out of the car, which indicates the whole line of cars had come to a complete stop.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, as Jerry Campbell, who was the wife of the mayor, said, well, of course the whole motorcade came to a halt, she said. There's no doubt about that. Where the mayor, by the way, her husband appears to have been profoundly involved in setting up the assassination, ironically, too.
We'll call you to task here. I I'd like to bring it back a little bit to.
Sure. Well, getting back to the larger point, and that is that if you have the media involvement, then they're intimately involved. That they're involved in deceiving the public. That they are the ones, and I think Jim has actually, because I've, in fact, I was just watching a video today of Jim's interview on Hannity and Combs, and where they tried to do a hatchet job on Jim, and that's typical of the major media. And, you know, Jim acquitted himself quite well, I think, and but that is typical. They will come after anybody who questions the government's conspiracy theory. And they will try to undermine someone's credibility by asking a question in a very snide way. And, of course, they have control of the microphone. And they can end the interview anytime it's not going well for them, which is typically what they do, and they did with you. They've rushed it. So because when they're losing, they want to end it quickly. But the bottom line is, when you look at these, for instance, you take the video of Jane Stanley, who is now announcing the collapse of Tower 7. She's from the BBC, and I'm convinced the BBC was involved in this from the beginning, okay? And whether Jane knew what was going on, whether she's just a pawn, I don't know, but certainly she's reading a script that she's been given that where she's announcing the collapse of Tower 7, and yet in the background, behind her, you can see Tower 7 is still standing.
She was 23 minutes early, Edward. 23 minutes yeah. early. She was announcing at 4:57, and it didn't happen until 5:20.
Yeah.
I thought, in reading your book, Edward, what I thought was the most shocking information concerned the tributes and the Mark Bingham. Maybe you'd just go through that a little bit, because I think that just shows the extent of media complicity.
Yes. They have a tribute on CNN.com to all of the crash victims. And there was an anomaly that was noticed, and the credit should go to Phil Jahan on this. And he and whoever he was working with discovered that an IPTC code, an IPTC code is a industry code from the International Press Telecommunications Council, and they have a standard. And this standard is a method by which there is some standardization within the industry for metadata. Now, metadata is electronic code that is embedded in a photograph when it is taken. So when a photograph is taken or created, okay, this code embeds details about the photograph. What instrument was used to take the photograph, you know, what the focal length was, all of the details of that photograph, when the photograph was taken. Now, they do that so that when photographs are exchanged electronically between media, they can track down and be able to attribute the proper copyright to that photograph. And so they have these standards, and they have a uniform standard, because if each instrument used a different software method to embed this metadata, then they would not be able to read it between agencies. So you'd have to have that particular manufacturer camera, and so you can imagine what a nightmare that would be in the news media. So they got together and created this standard. And so the standard puts metadata that can't be seen typically by a person unless they have the software to get into that metadata. And the software is very easy to come by on the Internet. You can download free programs that will allow you to access this IPTC metadata on photographs. And actually, any photograph you take, you can access that metadata that's on that photograph by using the software. Well, they accessed the metadata that was on the Mark Bingham photograph in particular, and there were others as well. But this one's particularly unique in that when they accessed that photograph, they noticed, and of course, now this is a photograph of a 1993 graduation where he's wearing his graduation cap, okay? However, the date on the photograph as to when it was created. The creation date of the photograph is August 30th, 2001. Okay, so that's 12 days prior. I'm sorry, that would be 12 days prior to 9/11. Okay, now the creator of that was an AP newspaper. Okay, and the question is why it was the Contra Costa Times. Why would the Contra Costa Times have his photograph, and they were using the instrument used to create the photograph, indicated in the IPTC, was Adobe Photoshop. So apparently they're creating the photograph on August 30th using Adobe Photoshop of Mark Bingham, and oddly enough, the photograph has captions. These captions can actually be added manually. So the IPTC allows for manual editing of the IPTC code. And one of the manual added codes is a caption that says, "Attacks Airline Victims Bingham." And in addition to that, there's another caption that says, "Mark Bingham, shown in this 1993 graduation photograph from the University of California, Berkeley, was killed aboard United Flight 93 from Newark, New Jersey to San Francisco, Tuesday, September 11, 2001, after it crashed outside of Pittsburgh." And then it says, "AP Photo Contra Costa Times Handout." Now, what is interesting is they could come up with some kind of explanation and say, well, we were going to do a story on Mark Bingham. The problem is, that would never fly. Why? Well, just stop and think about it. Think if they were going to do a story on Jim Fetzer. Would they grab your old graduation photo with a graduation cap and tassel? I don't think so. They simply would not do that. And so this, they're trying to portray this photograph as having come from the family, okay, and as sort of a folksy photograph, but yet it was created before the crash, which means they had identified him as an alleged victim before 9/11.
Power of psychic prophecy.
Well, would you suggest he was actually prepared 12 days in advance? So, I mean, you know, that's...
So they had this information all laid out to us. Now, what's interesting is they could, I'm sure, come up with some sort of explanation. You know, the computer people can change this and change that, but it would make no sense. See, their explanation would make no sense, particularly because of the nature of the photograph with the cap and gown. That's a problem for them, okay? Because that's the type of photograph they used. So obviously they're portraying it as having come from the family. Why would they have that on August 30th, 2001? And their response to this revelation was really interesting. They went and mined their website and started stripping the memorial of many, many photographs. So, for instance, they deleted 33 of the 40 photographs, leaving only 7 pictures of American Airlines Flight 77 victims on their website after this metadata issue came to light. They stripped... 56 pictures out of
guilt.
Yeah, they stripped 56 pictures from American Airlines Flight 11. So their response to this was not to give an explanation, but to go and try to cover this up. And interestingly enough, you can still obtain the original photographs using the Wayback Machine, and people can download them themselves. It's very easy to select the photograph. Using the Wayback Machine, you go back to the photograph they used. They can download Mark Bingham's photograph. They can use some of this free software that you can download, and they can read the metadata for themselves. And I would advise people to download the photograph pretty quick, because they have a tendency to now, once they find out that it's still available on the Wayback site as an old website, they'll try to then prevent you from accessing that. But you can read, as I have done, because I checked out what Jahan found out, and sure enough, I downloaded the photograph right from their CNN's website. I read the metadata, and sure enough, the date of creation for that photograph is August 30th, 2001.
So what this suggests is that they knew ahead of time a number of who the supposed victims were to be.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's shocking evidence that was all original to me in your book, which is a fascinating book, such a broad overview of different areas and such. I'd like, Edward, particularly Jim and I have been talking about the airplane hitting the South Tower. Could you say something about, I would have expected that would have been one of the later things you woke up to, in a sense. What led you to actually then doubt the existence of the plane hitting the South Tower? And am I correctly portraying what you believe?
Well, first of all, I don't believe a plane hit the South Tower. I believe it was an explosion. I believe the explosion in the North Tower. I don't believe there were any planes anywhere. And I believe that the planes that were depicted on television were computer-generated images, which, again, implicates the television studios. And I believe that some of these videos that they obtained from people on the street was a way of allowing them plausible deniability. In the intelligence community, that's something they always want to have. That is, some way they can, in some fashion, explain away their involvement in whatever criminal activity or treasonous activity they're involved in. And plausible deniability simply means if they have some plausible explanation to remove themselves from the situation, then they will create a scenario where they will have that. In other words, before they begin the crime, they think to themselves, how can we, if this is discovered, how can we have plausible deniability? Well, one of the ways is they can say, it wasn't our film. We got this from the man on the street, see. Mm-hmm. You've got to ask that person. You know, they must have monkeyed with the video, see. But the problem is there are videos from the broadcast networks that show no plane at all. And then when the video is rebroadcast after midnight on NBC, suddenly the foreground and background to the towers disappear, and you have what appears to be some sort of black blob that they portray as a plane. Okay, it appears to have somewhat the shape of a plane, and of course it's always a very poor image. And now the plane is, you see a plane smashing into the video, yet that same or very similar video shown earlier in the day, live footage, showed no plane at all. And there is yet a third version of that video that shows some sort of anomalous orb that is descending upon the buildings and just prior to the explosion in the building. So you have three different videos from the same vantage point showing three different things. And, interestingly enough, that orb that is descending on the building is at a different trajectory than is seen in the in many of the other videos that show a more level trajectory. So it looks very much like they have computer-generated images. I mean, that's the only explanation for it, because you have so many different videos and you have so many different trajectories. The only way to explain it is different people are creating these different videos, and they're doing it under a time pressure. They have to get these videos up on the air quickly, okay? And so the right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing. And so, therefore, they have videos that do not agree with each other as to the approach of the airplane. Not to mention the fact that, as Jim has already discussed, these planes are approaching at an impossible speed. There's no way at sea level they can go that fast.
Yeah, the videos aren't consistent with each other. And it's amazing. The main videos they've presented, they have these kind of dark blob airplanes. And whenever they do that, they always have a whitewash on the background.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not really seeing a plane against a normal background. They're using whitewashes and washes that obscure the background on these pictures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting when you look at and listen to some of the eyewitnesses as well. I mean, one of the witnesses that Leventhal, I think it was his, Rick Leventhal was on the street, and he came across a witness who overheard Leventhal talking about a plane striking the tower. And the witness steps up and says, there was no second plane. It was a bomb. A bomb went off in the building, he said. Not a second plane. And he was emphatic that it was not a second plane. And he said, who told you there was a second plane? And Leventhal turns to him and says, well, we were told the second plane. We saw it on television. And the guy said, no, I saw everything. There was no second plane. And Leventhal, what does he do? This reporter, this investigative reporter, he's going to tell the people what's really going on. He says, all right, thanks a lot, and then walks away.
Yeah,
here he has an eyewitness who says, I saw the whole thing, and Leventhal is completely disinterested in what he has to say. Why? Because Leventhal wasn't there to report what happened. Leventhal was there to tell people what they wanted the people to think happened. See?
Maybe Jim, do you have any thoughts or comments on?
No, I think everything Edward's been saying is right on, and it is true that there was obvious journalistic complicity on 9/11, and it's also true that even though Dan Rather was reporting honestly, others were not. For example, Merriman Smith, who was a famous reporter at the time, had access to a mic radio connection from his vehicle and reported that three shots had been fired immediately, when in fact the acoustics in Dealey Plaza were such that it was very difficult to determine how many shots actually were fired. We now believe that there were shooters at six different locations and nine or ten shots were fired. JFK himself was hit four different times, Connally 1-3, and there were three misses. But Merriman Smith was promoting what would become the government's mantra of three shots from a single assassin, and it was clearly not something that was justifiable at the time. So his broader point, Edward's broader point about JFK, was well taken, just as the points he's making about 9/11 are equally well taken, even more so.
Okay, so
I'd be interested in what Ed has to say about if he has access to his computer to 9/11 planes, no planes, and video fakery. If he would like to talk about, you know, some of the documents that we have uncovered and some of the photos and images in relation to all four of the crash sites, Shanksville, the Pentagon, and New York, I'd be very interested in his take and comments on the images you find on this website.
Well, it would be hard for me to talk and do that at the same time. So let me just talk generally in my knowledge of the photographs that are extant as I know them, and just discuss in general the what is depicted on in the photographs. For instance, at Shanksville, there's no indication a plane crashed there at all. Not only can anybody see that when looking at the photographs of the alleged plane crash, okay, but the eyewitnesses, they didn't see any plane there, and they indicated as such when they were interviewed. There was no indication a plane had crashed there, so there were no engine parts, there's no tail section, there were no seats, there's no wheels, okay? There's just a hole there. And, you know, to suggest that a plane crashed there is really ludicrous. And the same with the Pentagon. The eyewitnesses who saw a plane fly over the Pentagon saw it fly and approach the Pentagon from a different point, okay? They saw the plane approach north of the Citgo station, whereas the government's theory has the plane traveling south of the Citgo station. And the evidence suggests that that was a decoy plane to make people think that a plane actually hit, but the plane flew over the Pentagon. And I discuss that in my book. And I go into some detail with regard to that.
I don't know if you've heard me mention, Edward, but the trucker buddy of a friend of mine actually was in front of the Pentagon at the time and told my friend, whose name is Roy Schaefer, that he had seen a large plane fly toward the building and then swerve over it. He actually witnessed it personally. So I told Roy I'd like to get him on the air if he would ask his friend Dave Ball whether he would do that. And he said Dave was reluctant. I was explaining to Roy how witnesses are far more secure once they have reported what they have to say, and it's been archived in the public domain. Indeed, before we could get back to Dave Ball, he was found dead in an abandoned building about 2 weeks later.
No way.
It's very much like Barry Jennings, who, of course, was from the emergency management for New York City, who went to the
Yes.
mayor's command and control center in Building 7 that morning and discovered, you know, coffee still steaming, sandwiches half-eaten. A fireman came along and said, "We got to get you out of here." He reported hearing explosions taking place while he was there. A stairwell was virtually blown out from under his feet. He felt himself stepping over dead bodies. When he got out into the sunlight, he was interviewed by reporters. You can find his interviews on YouTube, although some of them have been sanitized. But just days before NIST was to repeat its final report, release its final report on Building 7, Barry Jennings died mysteriously. So anyone who thinks that the government isn't taking steps to make sure there aren't a lot of witnesses who can contradict what it has to say are sadly mistaken.
Yep. Yeah, we're fortunate there's a lot in the public domain in terms of all the videos and media coverage of the day, which provides an ample body of criminal evidences.
Yeah. Yeah, the...
About Shanksville, Edward, Colonel George Nelson, whom I mentioned previously, an air crash investigation expert from the, you know, now retired, observed that it looked to him as though someone had taken a bulldozer out there, dug a ditch, filled it with trash, and blown it up. As you observe, and as the two reporters on the scene reported, the eerie aspect of the crash site was there was no indication that any plane had crashed there.
That's right. Yeah.
And you have that interesting picture of the woman holding a photograph of a kind of a small mushroom cloud, which was supposed to be the explosion. And it's perfectly symmetrical. It's not, because an airplane coming in with lateral motion would spread the explosion over an area and be, whereas this picture of the explosion, it was like a perfectly symmetrical mushroom behind the woman.
Right. And, you know, the government, I think, had to address that, and so that's why they came up with the idea that it was almost a vertical impact in order to address, I think, what you're referring to, because I think they saw that right away.
Mm-hmm.
And because when a plane hits at, in an angle, then you're going to have a debris field which spreads for hundreds of yards, thousands of yards, not simply one impact zone with one hole. And so they had to come up with a virtual vertical impact in order to explain why there was no debris field, and also there would be also a spreading of smoke and fire. Yeah. It would be very much a crash like that would be very much like what you've seen in videos of napalm, where it explodes over an area as a plane would crash, and if it's coming at an angle, let's say it's a 45 degree angle or maybe a 60 degree angle, it would have some forward to a momentum that would cause it to then spread the explosion over a large area. So you're absolutely right, yeah.
It was interesting. I know, have you read Judy Wood's book, Edward? Yeah,
yes, of course. Yes, I think
it's
she has done a fabulous
job. I've, because I've been so interested in the no plane theory, like it's interesting, in Judy Wood's book, she doesn't discuss it at all, but she has one line where she says that there are no evidences of planes hitting the towers. And she doesn't elaborate at all upon it, but she makes that comment. And that's interesting because so many people think there's so much evidence, at least of the plane hitting the South Tower.
Yeah.
I think that's
She's trying to be very focused and addressing only the issue of directed energy. And one of the interesting things what I found was interesting is a statement that she made that there was organic material at the molecular level that was also found along with the evidence of molecular portions of metal like vanadium and iron. And vanadium, for instance, the boiling point of vanadium is 6,000 degrees. And so and that's what you would need in order to have molecular-sized particles of vanadium. And apparently it's one of the components of steel. And there was vanadium found amongst the dust. But alongside of that was organic material. Now, you stop and think about that. 6,000 degrees to get to the molecular level of vanadium, and yet also there's organic molecular material right alongside of it. It had to be something other than heat. It could not have been nanothermite or any other sort of thermite. We call it thermate. It doesn't matter. It couldn't have been done by heat. It had to be something else.
I would like both of your opinions about this. Like my comment a bit is, it seems to me that there were different explosions in the building, and the fact that, I don't think we have to doubt that there was nanothermite. Like, we can accept that, and still that doesn't mean that there wasn't other weaponry used to take down the buildings, like, in terms of the dustification process. Like, would you agree with that? Like, I'm not sure the evidence is saying, well, no, they didn't find nanothermite. I don't think we have to say that. It's just that if they found that, well, that was part of the explosive materials used, but that wasn't what brought the towers down. What do you think?
I may have mentioned earlier, Christopher, there is a new article disputing that what was found in the dust by the Jones-Ryan-Herrett group actually was nanothermite. But more importantly is that nanothermite on its own does not have the explosive capacity to pulverize the concrete or to destroy the steel. So even if nanothermite was involved, the more important explanatory aspect is whatever else was used along with it to bring about the conversion of those 500,000-ton buildings into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust. That's the residual question that nanothermite does not answer.
No. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, there were many, many events that took place prior to the dustification of those two towers. And Chris, as you have mentioned, there were two explosions that could have had all sorts of devices used for the pyrotechnic effect of those explosives. So, there could be a number of technologies being used, but there's no way, and I agree with Jim, there's no way that you can explain the dustification of these towers through thermite. In fact, there is a video that anybody can watch of the collapse of the North Tower, where you can see about a 50-story spire, and it's a distant shot, but the spire is a remnant after the building has been dustified. So now we have a 50-story spire of steel columns and steel girders that are sometimes 4 inches thick and maybe 2 inches at the upper levels. These are massive, this massive structure of steel. And you don't see it tipping over, you don't see it collapsing, you don't see it crumbling. What you see is the tower is turning to dust. Now, there's no way.
What you're talking about, Edward, is a remnant of the core column of the North Tower. And, in fact,
yes.
I feature videos showing that remnant turning to dust on a blog of mine entitled New 9/11 Photos Released, where you can see the sequence of the destruction of the North Tower. And, of course, if the building is being converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust, then so are the parts of the building, which means it shouldn't be all that surprising that we should find in some instances footage of parts of the building, in this case, remnants of the core column of the North Tower, as it is being converted into dust.
Yep. And, by the way, Judy Wood does an interesting study on the Bankers Trust building. And that's something that people have not really focused on. There has not been a great deal of investigation done on it. She's the only one who seems to have brought that out. And what that was a building that was apparently damaged, but in a very odd way. They reconstructed the building. They fixed it. It was fixed. And once they fixed it, certain odd things started happening. And suddenly, they decided they had to tear the entire building down after they spent millions and probably hundreds of millions of dollars repairing that building from the 9/11 attacks. And she opines that there was residual effect from whatever the directed energy was using. And there is a residual effect on the steel. And it was causing the steel to dustify or corrode and actually spontaneously catch fire within the Bankers Trust building. And they were having some serious issues with the structural integrity of that building, and so it required them to very quietly, it was never in the media, nobody ever discussed it, but they very quietly disassembled that building from the top down. They basically, they did it in a very methodical way so as not to hurt any of the surrounding buildings, and it's no longer. It's done. It's gone. And she has noticed a residual effect that she alleges is residual effect, and she makes a very compelling argument for it, that there's premature rusting on some of the new structures that are being built in that area that is a residual effect of some of the, apparently, the directed energy that was being used. She has a fascinating book, Where Did the Towers Go? It's absolutely fascinating. And she supports what she says, with her findings and her expertise, and it's a really quite an interesting book.
By far the most impressive compendium ever assembled of evidence about the effects of the attacks on the Twin Towers that has to be explained by an adequate theory. One of the strongest forms of support, I would suggest, for her view is that while Building 7, which, of course, underwent a more or less conventional or classic controlled demolition, was rebuilt almost immediately, they had enduring problems with the Twin Towers, and anyone who is familiar with what has happened now realizes that they were unable to rebuild on those locations and instead created two enormous memorial pools that are made of marble and water, which appear to be occupying some of the most valuable property in the world. And I assure you that that would not be the case, except there was no way to avoid it, that they were unable to rebuild because of the residual effects of whatever was involved here, which appears to have involved some form of molecular dissociation.
Wow, fascinating.
Now, where is the tower in relation to where the other two towers were that's being built now?
Oh, well, that's a skew. That's a good question, because where the two towers were originally, you have these enormous pools that are really quite, they're beautiful, but they aren't 110-story structures. So, whether with the state of the Freedom Tower, I can't tell you precisely, but that's a really good question that deserves to be further explored.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and we'll have to see over time if we see other residual effects in the new Freedom Tower.
Yeah, and one thing that Dr. Woods was pointing out was this rising steam. It seemed to be steam, but it wasn't. It was a sort of a cloud that was rising from the rubble. And if it was, in fact, steam, which is how it's always been portrayed in the media, then the people that are walking over that steam, they would be cooked. If it was hot enough for steam to be rising, and by the way, there was evidence that their and they had a problem with their shoes only lasting a day because the soles would, they said, melt. Now, if it was hot enough to have their soles melt, their feet would be cooked. And so what we have here is the continuing residual effect of whatever the directed energy that they were using, causing the soles on the shoes to also become molecularly disassociated and dissolve. And so they had to have a constant supply of shoes. And by the way, if it was heat that was causing that, the steam shovels would cease working because you could see them picking up things that were, appeared to be glowing. But yet, if they were actually picking up something that was glowing, which would suggest that it was in the area of over 2,000 degrees, the hydraulics on the steam shovel would cease to work. They could not work with that kind of heat. So there was something else going on there other than heat.
By the way, I've done a search on the Freedom Tower, and apparently they have it up to the 76th top floor already. And they have some shots of what it looks like from there. When it's completed, it'll reach 1,776 feet to the top spire, so that you can actually go on to Today's Show takes a tour of One World Trade Center to see the current state of construction. But it has to be offset from the location of the original Twin Towers. Remember, originally there were seven different buildings there. So they would have had a series of options. It would be interesting to look at a map as to where it is located, where it is situated in relation to where the original Twin Towers were, where we have these memorial fountains. By the way, of course, you're right. Edward Judy refers to that misting as fuming. And,
yeah,
you know,
fuming is a better term.
If it were actually steam, that it would have the kinds of effects you're talking about. But this question of whether there were these pools of molten metal that endured for months and months after has been one of the more vexing in 9/11 research. I'm inclined to believe that Judy is probably right about it, that they may not have existed, but that there were other effects that they sought to explain away by insisting that there were those pools of molten metal.
Well, and the she discusses that the people that were jumping from the towers, she said they're trying to tell us something. And she opines that what they're trying to tell us is that they were being microwaved. That is, they jumped not because of the heat of the flames that were burning in that building, but because something was causing them to feel as though they were being cooked. Mm-hmm. And so they jumped. They felt that was their option, that death was better than being cooked, because
and we see
there was
those,
there's
none of the falling bodies seem to be on fire or to show evidences of being burnt. I've never seen that. They mainly
there was a horrendous mass of people jumping, and the carnage was unbelievable. I didn't realize the degree to which people were jumping until I read her book, and she tried to explain, you know, if they were jumping and the fires were not hot. In fact, they were not. The you have the firemen in the building. You have the firemen. You can hear the radio transmission. We have two isolated pockets of fire, and they're not jumping. They're not hot. So why are these people jumping? And she opines that these whatever it is that they used was causing these people to feel as though they were on fire, and microwaves would explain that. And microwaves would also explain why while the towers with the steel and the concrete and everything that's involved in construction of those towers turned to dust, you had mountains and mountains of paper flowing everywhere because they don't have sufficient mass to be affected by microwaves. And you can see that when you use your own microwave in the house. You put a paper plate in, you're good to go. Okay? If you put tin foil in there, it'll catch on fire.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's an interesting analogy. I noticed that we're coming down to the end of the show. Edward, maybe first you could give out your websites and where people can buy 9/11 enemies, foreign and domestic.
Well, thank you. Yeah, at www.911enemies.com is the website, and it's available on Amazon and Lulu.
And because there are so many
graphics in it, I haven't figured, other than a PDF, it's available in PDF on Lulu. Because there are so many graphics and I need large graphics in there, I haven't figured out a way to get it on Kindle so that it's actually readable and digestible. So basically, the two versions would be PDF and then in paperback. And that's because the graphics are so large. They don't show up, I don't think, as well.
Just an excellent overview of 9/11 researches, and then in addition, you bring together the evidences pointing at Israeli and Mossad involvement, and you pull that all together. A very valuable book. We thank you so much, Edward, for your work. And Jim,
well, thank you.
I'll give you a moment to any parting comments to Edward. Jim? Oh, hello? Are you there, Edward?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, I don't know if we've lost Jim.
Apparently we lost Jim.
Oh dear. Okay. Oh, well, that's a shame. We'll see if they're able to pick him up. But we're kind of down to the end of time. Well, thank you, Edward, for being on and being on with Jim. I'm sorry we kind of got disrupted a little bit at the end. Any final comments? What do you see, Edward? Do you think there's any hope that these people will ever be brought to justice?
Well, was anybody brought to justice with regard to the Kennedy assassination?
No. Nope.
We have a pretty good idea of who was involved in 9/11. The problem is getting the word out. Whether they're brought to justice, we can only hope. We can only hope.
Yeah, before they take us into another, it's the same people who want to begin another criminal war against Iran.
That's right. A threat to the
future of this planet. It's just terrible.
Yep.
Okay, thank you, Edward.
Thank you for having me.
Again sometime.
All right, thank you.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye-bye.
And I guess, Jim, you're not there? Okay, so we're down to the end of the show. I've just got a minute here. I would like to encourage people to have a look at my website at zeropoint.ca. And you can also there, you can see my book is called 1137. And it includes my studies of the fabled airplanes and scripted witnesses of 9/11, as well as a variety of other evidences about the New World Order and what's happening in the world today. And it's a call for hope that humankind can reestablish international law on this planet before we descend into utter chaos and devastation. And hopefully we can turn the tide. And to me, my heroes these days, they're not men who play games with balls, but instead they're men like Edward Hendry and Jim Fetzer who seek after the truth and are persistent and put their heart into it and do it because they believe in truth and justice. And we all have to face the monster upon us in these times. And the more we wake other people up and wake up ourselves, then we have the chance, I still believe, to turn the tide. So we're down to the end of the show. Thank you, BBS Radio, Don and Doug and Seth in the studios there. And we'll be back in 2 weeks, and I'll have Dee back with us next week, and we're bound to have a very interesting show. Until that time, adieu. Remember yourself, keep heart, that try to be have courage, a new heart, and face the beast of modern times. Thank you.